continue with what we have got to do. The department is here to speak to us on what we requested them to come to speak to us on. Climate change and where are we. Having come from COP20 and how do we proceed to Paris as government now, not as the department, as government. It can't be a departmental matter. It's a government-wide matter. But also, how do we involve other stakeholders in this very important aspect of dealing with climate change, in the or negative impact of climate change in our country. That's why we're here. We're just dealing with that matter. But we also know that arising out of your carbon budgets, there are certain things that are also called carbon tax. There are people who speak to us about that later on. There's a relevant department that is a tax, and that can't be the Department of Environmental Affairs. So, colleagues, with this then says to welcome all of you to this portfolio committee on environmental affairs. Those of you who might not know who's speaking, the speaker is the chair of the Committee on Environmental Affairs in the Parliament of the Republic of South Africa. Next to me, we have a lady here who's the secretary. In fact, she runs our lives. She's the secretary of the committee. She's Miss Matubela. Now, Matubela is her maiden surname. And I know that she's not saying alone, but just leave that for now. Then we have another member that's like, Mary, can you introduce yourself?
My name is Kerry Stander, and I am a member of the Portfolio Committee.
I happen to be Silence Makubela, a member as well.
Helen Kukan, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Johanna Mulemalwege, member of the Portfolio Committee. Kira
Balmiliam, member of the committee.
Thank you. That then tells you who we are. Of course, we also know that from the committee side, we have that we are very that we are lucky and unlucky. But one of our members got married this weekend. Now, so I think she's now busy honeymoon, so she's then not here. And we say, well, that's honorable member Stian Kamp. She got married this weekend. Then another member lost her luggage this morning. That's Pumane. So that's why she couldn't be here. He couldn't be here because she's trying to find out where her luggage is. And we just hope that we'll be able to get his luggage. But besides that, we are courageous. We can continue with our work as required by our laws. Judy, we are in your capital hands now. Tell us who's with you. We say now we have a house full. You've got all these climate change scientists.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Good morning, and thank you for the invitation to this morning's briefing. I'm Judy Beaumont. I'm responsible for the climate change and air quality portfolio at the Department of Environment Affairs. Deborah Ramalope is the Chief Director responsible for mitigation, emission reduction in our branch. Olga Chaoke is responsible for energy mitigation, focusing on the portfolio of energy and what can be done in terms of reducing emissions in the energy sector. And she is director working with Deborah in her team. And then, of course, Bongi Seni, we all know, and that is from our department. And then Memory is from Treasury, and she will be joined a little later by Cecil Morden, and possibly by the DDG Ishmael Mamonia, but it depends on the timing with the way from the go with the Standing Committee on Finance, which apparently is underway right now. Chair, we, as...
Before you continue, who are the others? Or you don't know them, that they can do them that. If you don't know them, we know Errol, of course. Can we have other colleagues introducing yourselves, what we know, who's here?
My name is Marco Schmidt, I'm a financial relations officer,
My name is Pancha, good morning everybody, I'm coming to the role of Greece.
Okay, you're from?
Jutalo, legal group.
Jutalo,
good morning, I'm
here
to
take from the
environment.
Okay.
Good morning, I'm
from Jacob Holden.
From
Pioneer Foods. Okay. Yeah, okay. We know.
Yeah, my name's Ella from PNG.
Okay.
Good morning, I'm from Melody and I'm also from PNG.
Okay. By the way, so that we are all on the same page, you know that we all went to COP20 and there were certain decisions that were taken at COP20. Those decisions include all countries coming up with nationally intended contributions or intended nationally determined contributions that they are supposed to report on before COP21. And we believe that our reporting period is like October somewhere. So we, of course, again, we locate even the discussions there as a kind of within our climate change response policy. And that response policy also has what we now call green economy strategy. So within all those, we know that for us to arrive at nationally determined contributions on greenhouse gas reduction, we then had to meet with various stakeholders, industry, you name them. Again, of course, we hope that also your groups that's the point we made, that there is no way that government and government working alone can do justice to this. Government can make the necessary conducive regulatory environment in consultation with industry, then say how to move forward as a country, as a continent, and as a world community when we get to COP21 later this year. So that's broadly where we are locating this briefing. But secondly, we all know that even at government level, government has got so many wings and pillars. So even at government level, it can't only be the responsibility of the Department of Environmental Affairs that is supposed to take forward this very important matter that affects all people, particularly the most vulnerable in Africa, in South Africa, the rural poor. We therefore, that's why we then asked, and of course you can respond to that in person, how do we coordinate with other government departments? We all know that the major contributor to our greenhouse gas emissions is our energy sector now, as we speak, where basically it's our coal that is contributing majorly as a source of energy to this greenhouse gas emissions. How do we reduce our dependence to this coal source? Of course, we also know that in our plan, there is in our green economy strategy and also plan, there is a desire and an idea of reducing at least our dependence on coal to from 81 to reasonable percentages, about 40 or so, but at the same time ensure uptake of renewable energies in the ensuing period. How are we doing? And we can't do that alone as a department. We can only do that in consultation. Working together with the policies that I'm speaking to are not departmental policies. These are government policies. How are we then working together? How is the coordination? Because after this, we are going to call everybody. We will call you and everybody else. So that those that are supposed to do something on retrofit of government buildings, tell us where they are. Those who are supposed to do something on our transport, these emissions that come CO2 from our transport emissions, how do we get people from cars to buses or whatever? How far are we in relation to that? But also on the energy sector, the industry sector, how are we doing both at public and private sector level? Are we meeting these goals of renewable energies, reduction in dependency on coal? So we can't be asking you or what we ask these questions, but we think people that will be better placed are the relevant departments. Therefore, you will give us your initial take of where we are in relation to even taking forward implementation of the strategy and these consultations, but obviously at some stage, because we also need to know, we are just representing some little aspect of Parliament. Parliament itself, before we even go to COP21, Parliament must have a sense as a collective, where are we as a country? How does Parliament get this sense? How does Parliament also engage with other parliamentarians? Because you know, when we get to Paris, we must engage with other like-minded parliamentarians in Africa and everywhere else, and these progressive parliamentarians also in the world who think like us when it comes to adaptations and mitigations on climate change. Therefore, as Parliament, we must know what we are talking about. But before we even get there to Paris, this climate change affects our people. Therefore, our view as Parliament is that we must also speak to our people. Tell them what, or consult with them on what are these adaptation and mitigation scenarios that we are putting on the table. How it will affect them, and how it will affect our economy, job creation, you name it. All these matters that affect our people. But knowing very well that if we don't do anything, the consequences are too ghastly to contemplate. That we know. That we know. We know that there is no way that we can just say these things won't happen. They are happening already. Our islands are being threatened as we speak now, and our agriculture is being threatened as we speak now. And you know, we were watching the other day, whilst we might not say that the Nepal incidents are linked to climate change, but we wouldn't like to see anything akin to that happening in the West because of climate change. So, or negative impacts of climate change. So, I think I've located where we are as Parliament on this matter, so that even your sticky notes speak to where we were when we left. What is that place?
Lima.
Yeah. You see, that it looks like those Lima. Yes. Jody, we are now in your capable hands.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you for that introduction, because I think that gives me direction also in terms of how to position our presentation. Chair, if I may just take about 5 of the points that you have raised, because some of those points will not necessarily be addressed here in this presentation, but I think it's quite useful also to set ourselves up in terms of any further briefings that would be useful. From in terms of the preparation for COP 21, the negotiating team is in fact leaving this week. In fact, some of the team members are leaving today to go to Bonn for the mid-year preparatory negotiation process that is taking place over the next 2.5 weeks in Germany. That is an absolutely critical negotiation time. That is the time that all the negotiators start getting a handle on the draft negotiating text for a new legal agreement. And really the extent of progress that is made in Bonn now in the next 2.5 weeks will indicate the kind of intensity of negotiation work that takes place between now and the 1st of December. So, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I think that also working with Chileka, we have suggested that there would be a briefing to you quite shortly after the negotiations, which conclude in mid-June, so that we're able to give you a sense of some of the scenarios that are emerging in terms of the different positionings of the different country groupings and country blocks, to get a sense of where we might end up at the end of COP21, where the real hard down-to-the-wire negotiating issues are, and the further preparation that South Africa needs to do together with the Africa Group to ensure that we are a very robust team and a strong negotiating force in Paris. We are already participating extensively in a number of informal discussions that the COP president, the Minister of International Relations of France, has been convening. And these are informal discussions to facilitate the discussion around the intractable, the so-called difficult and in some cases intractable negotiation issues to try and find what the landing zones might be. It's useful to take those discussions outside of the formal negotiations because it gives all of the negotiators a sense of where we might be able to conclude in Paris. From a South African perspective, we are working with each province to set up a provincial conference. And at each of those provincial conferences, we will be consulting on South Africa's position going into COP21. We'll be consulting on South Africa's discussion document on our intended nationally determined contribution. And then it will provide an opportunity to take the next step beyond the national conference that we had last year on climate change and start focusing on implementation at a provincial level. So in each case, it will be a jointly organized conference between the province and DEAR, led by the province, and provide an opportunity for that kind of consultation that you mentioned, the important thing about ensuring that people that are on the ground are able to interact with these issues. Today, our focus from a national implementation perspective is focusing on emission reduction, but I think it's important, as you say, to locate that emission reduction work in the context of a much bigger picture of implementation, which includes adapting to the impacts of climate change. And there's extensive work that is underway, not only at sectoral level, but also with provinces. We've done a vulnerability assessment, working with three of the provinces to do a specific assessment of the vulnerabilities from a climate change perspective within those provinces. And from the vulnerability assessment, the province is then able to take the next step and say, well, in relation to these areas of vulnerability, whether it's from a drought perspective, a flood perspective, a water security perspective, a food security perspective, a health issue perspective, in relation to those specific potential vulnerabilities, what is the kind of adaptation planning that needs to take place? And I think it might be useful also to be able to present that work to the Portfolio Committee. It is quite interesting, it is quite cutting edge work that is taking place, and it takes us one step beyond the previous work that was done around looking at each sector, whether it was the agriculture sector, the water sector, the health sector, etc., to now bring it down to a geographical level, which is one step closer to the ground. Of course, there's also detailed work that is ongoing on monitoring, evaluation, and putting together a system that enables South Africans not only understand impact and outcome of the work that is being done, both to adapt to the impact of climate change, but also to reduce our emissions, but also to be able to monitor and track the kind of impacts that South Africa is experiencing. Now, of course, this is not work that is done by the department alone. This is work that is done by collaboratively done with the many institutions that are engaging in this area of work. The South African Weather Service, for example, the Agricultural Research Centre, the Water Research Centre, etc., all of whom are in some way doing quite a lot of interesting research work on the extent to which South Africa is already and in the future may be impacted by climate change. Just to say that as part of our nationally determined contribution, where we are looking not only at our contribution to the global effort of reducing emissions, but also looking at our contribution in terms of adapting to the impact of climate change, we're doing quite interesting work that I think is also going to be fairly cutting edge from a global perspective on costing the kind of adaptation, implementation options that will be needed under different mitigation scenarios, under different global mitigation scenarios. So in the event that we get a highly ambitious outcome in Paris, which at this stage is, and I'll be honest, there's a lot of work still to go, then with a good outcome and extensive commitment to reducing global emissions, it means that the adaptation costs and impacts would be lower. With a less ambitious outcome and a gap between global emission reductions that are required in order to keep the global temperature to below 2 degrees versus what the global pledges actually are, if that gap is not filled and you're not able to get a global commitment to fill that gap, obviously from an African and Southern African perspective, the costs and adaptation impacts will be higher. So we are, as a country, trying to show what those costs are likely to be under the different mitigation scenarios. And the reason this is really important work for Africa and from a South African perspective is that we are arguing very strongly in the negotiations that we need to have agreement on a global adaptation goal. At the moment in the negotiations, the discussions go around the global temperature goal and a global emission reduction goal. And from a South African and African perspective, we also have to be talking about a global adaptation goal which recognizes that the adaptation costs cannot only be borne at a national level. Those adaptation costs have a global dimension to it, given the linkage between global emission reduction scenarios and adaptation costs. So, Chair, I think just to locate the work we're presenting today in the bigger picture and to suggest some of, I think, the areas of further work that needs to be done. Or briefing work that I think may be useful for the committee. Just to say also that in terms of, as you said, the work of other departments, we cannot do this work alone. We coordinate with other departments through the Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change and also through the medium-term strategic framework. Which, as honourable members will know, is a 5-year commitment under the National Development Plan. So from an environmental perspective, we have taken the National Development Plan areas of focus for sustainable development and environmental issues, and together with the relevant departments, including the Department of Public Works, the Department of Energy, the Department of Transport, Department of Agriculture and Forestry, Department of Water, all of the relevant departments, we have collectively identified the medium-term strategic framework targets that need to be made over the next 5 years. So, for example, and Treasury is one of those departments. So, Treasury has a five-year target in respect of different public finance instruments, including the carbon tax. The Department of Energy has a target in terms of the integrated resource plan, the integrated energy planning process, etc. So that's the accountability framework within which we're working with other national departments. And I think it would be very useful to hear from those national departments the extent to which progress is being made, for example, in terms of the renewable energy IDP program, the National Department of Transport public transport program, the Department of Public Works energy efficiency and public buildings program, etc. The focus then is today is what instruments need to be in place in order for South Africa to meet its commitment of a 34% and 32% reduction against our business as usual emissions by 2020-2025. That is our Copenhagen pledge, and that broadly will be the substance of the mitigation elements of our intended nationally determined contribution. The South Africa therefore needs to put in place instruments that can encourage, incentivize, facilitate, and regulate the reduction of emissions over a period of time. And of course that is where the carbon tax is a key instrument, the carbon budgeting is a key instrument, and then there's a suite of different instruments out there, whether they are regulatory or whether they are technology or whether they are instruments that facilitate behavior change, and we will give you a selection of those instruments that we have been looking at through a mapping of the different instruments that South Africa already has in place and where some of the gaps are. So Deborah will take us through the work that has been done, the mitigation potential analysis was concluded last year, that has set us up and that has done all the prep work in order for us to start defining and designing the nature of an emission reduction system. And such an emission reduction system would include the key instruments of setting a carbon budget, setting a carbon tax, having mandatory reporting, mandatory planning, and monitoring and evaluation. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members. The presentation for has a first to describe on mitigation system. The overview is, I'll just give you a picture of what our emissions look like nationally, and the mitigation potential analysis, which is a piece of work that Judy spoke to about earlier, that it was concluded and approved by Cabinet last year, and the development of the overall mitigation system and some of the certain projects and roles of different government departments in terms of emission reduction. This gives a picture of our emissions, and I'm sure most of you expected this. The GHG inventory was presented to Cabinet as well. This shows that most of our emissions come from the power sector. They're on your right, and they're under manufacturing and construction, basically industrial processes. And one of the growth sectors is the transport sector at 9%. This is being updated at the moment, as you can see that this is the 2009 data. Now moving on to the South Africa's mitigation potential analysis, the piece of work that was completed. This piece of work basically what it looks at, it's what is technically possible in terms of emission reduction in different sectors. And we set up a technical working group, we worked with business, we had NGOs, we had labor in the technical working group to come up with what is technically possible in terms of emission reductions in different sectors. This gives you the overall approach as contemplated in the National Climate Change Response Policy, which basically says that we need to assess the mitigating potential analysis in different sectors that have been concluded. And in fact, this year we will be starting with the updating, because there's some of the assumptions that we use in mitigation potential analysis that needs to be updated, like the fuel cost of some energy sources. And the policy also goes to the definition of desired emission reduction outcomes in different sectors. That's a piece of work that's currently underway. And the use of mix of mitigation policies and measures. Here an example would be a carbon tax and all other measures. I'll give you a summary of other measures in different sectors. And the formulation of mitigation plans. So once we've concluded the carbon budget, we expect companies to submit mitigation plans to tell us exactly how are they going to reduce their emissions, especially the carbon budget that we would have allocated to them. And the mitigation potential analysis was done in 5 sectors. We did in the energy, industry, transport, waste, agriculture, forestry, and land use sectors. So we focused on those 5 key sectors for the mitigation potential analysis. And you can see it as mainly an update of the piece of work that was done, I think it was in 2008, 2007, on the long-term mitigation scenarios, which is quite outdated now. So this is an update of that. The objectives of the piece of work was basically to project the nature of greenhouse gases, to see where do we see ourselves in terms of emission growth or reduction up to 2050, and we've identified and analyzed mitigation opportunities in different sectors. And I'll give you an example of some of the sectors that we look at and what are the opportunities available and at what cost do those opportunities should be implemented. And then we assess the socio-economic impact of the mitigation opportunities identified. So what's going to be the impact on the economy? And we developed emission reduction pathways. This is basically a categorization of the different sectors that I spoke to. We did those 5 sectors at the top, and then you have your sub-sectors underneath those. So what we did, we produced, for instance, a marginal abatement cost curve, which is basically a curve that shows you what potential is there in the electricity sector and what cost is it available. And we did that for all these other sectors. Those that are not included is because there was no data to come up with the mitigation opportunities. And here I've selected the electricity. I'll show an example of a marginal abatement cost curve electricity, and the same applies to commercial buildings. So I call it agriculture, forestry, and other land use. That's the agricultural sector. The approach that we took, we basically built models for each one of those subsectors that are projected in the previous slide. And we have developed your marginal abatement concepts for each one of those. The data that was used comes from the JG inventory. At that point in time, it was before it was approved by cabinet. It was still advanced, but not much has changed ever since then. We've also used electricity consumption data from the DOE, and then the GDP growth assumptions attached to the National Development Plan. That's what we used to make sure that there's alignment. And in this case, we used 4.2 economic growth as an assumption for this piece of work. We did some sensitivity analysis based on the low growth. For instance, if the economy were to grow at 3.8, what would the emissions look like? And if we grow at a high growth rate of 5.4, what would the mitigation potential look like? And then the reference case that we used 2000 basically assumed that there was no mitigation from 2000. And you see as I present the MACCAPS, the regional abatement concepts, that you have what we call without measures. So there was no intervention in terms of emission reduction. Companies did not do anything there under the WARM, which is the without measures. And under the with existing measure scenarios, that's where you include interventions like your IRP and other mitigation interventions and projects that have been implemented by industry. This shows the emission projections basically up to 2050, and it doesn't differ that much from the JG inventory pie chart that you saw at the beginning, with blue at the bottom there showing the energy sector at the bottom there, and then the second one there is industry, and then you have transport there, and then you have the upholding, the agriculture, forestry, and other edges, and then you have your waste. This is projection of emissions basically. And then here it's basically the sensitivity analysis that we did here, the high growth, the 5.4 economic growth, solid line, and then the broken line here is a log group of 3.8. Okay, an example of one of the marginal arrangement cost cuts in the commercial buildings. We produced this for each one of those sectors for 2020, which is short term, 2030, and 2050 for each one of the sub-sectors. And basically what it looks at on your left there is the price, the cost, how much is it going to cost us if we implement some of these measures. And at the bottom here is your emission reduction. Here is your emission reduction. So the width here basically shows how big we can go in terms of reducing emissions. And because it's, if you look at the commercial buildings like CAF here, all of them are underneath the zero. So you can achieve all these interventions at a negative cost. These are the most attractive interventions that we should be implementing because they come at a negative cost. And I'll show you the other one that shows the ones that come at a high cost. So basically, there's savings in all of these measures that can be implemented in commercial buildings, with the passive building or improved thermal design coming out top in terms of emission reductions. Look at how big it is in terms of emission reduction. So that should be one of the low-hanging fruits that we should be implementing. And moving on to the power sector, African and MEC for 2030. I did not include the 2020, but if you get into the document, which is publicly available now, you can see the MEC for 2020 as well. There it showed that the total potential abatement for 2030 and the largest part of it can be delivered through nuclear. That's the biggest chunk there in orange or brownish color, that one. That's nuclear. And followed by coal power plants with carbon capture and storage. You know the South African Carbon Capture and Storage Plant has done a lot of work and research on the carbon capture and storage piece of work. So that's where most of the abated opportunities are in the power sector. And the national picture, this is what it shows. It shows that we can implement about 37.8 of the mitigation potential available to us at a negative cost. So if we were to target the lowest hanging fruit, this is the chunk that we should be implementing immediately to reduce emissions in the country. And now I'm moving on to the development of the mitigation system. There's four elements, main elements in the development of the mitigation system. That project that is currently underway. The main elements being the carbon budget, and I'll talk to that briefly in the next slide. And the pollution prevention plans, which is what we refer to as mitigation plans. The policy talks about the mitigation plans, but the only hook to cope with regulations was in the Air Quality Act, hence the wording around pollution prevention plans. But the regulations that we'll be publishing will be called the pollution prevention plans in respect of greenhouse gas, to use the hook from the Air Quality Act. Up until we have our own act, then we'll revert that mitigation plan. The third element of the mitigation system is the carbon tax, and the fourth element is monitoring evaluation. This shows an emission reduction cycle. The first one on the left, it basically shows the current space. This is where we are. We have the mitigation potential analysis at the top, which was concluded in 2014. And in 2015, we are in the process of setting carbon budgets. And carbon tax work is also currently underway. And we will be asking companies, once we've allocated carbon budgets, we'll be asking companies to submit pollution prevention plans to tell us exactly how are they going to reduce their emissions. And then the annual reporting that they need to do to the department to tell us how are you progressing in terms of emission reduction. And then assessment of compliance, which will only kick in after first phase, which is in the second phase. The one on the right is basically your second and subsequent phases. The first phase will run for 5 years, which is from 2016 up to 2020, and the second phase and subsequent phase will run from 2021. Here, if there's an IRP update, we're going to use that as a basis for the mitigation potential analysis, as I indicated that we already updated the MPA this year, because there's certain assumptions that needs to be updated. And then setting carbon budgets for the next cycle. The intention is to set carbon budgets for at least 3 cycles to create the certainty for industry and for them to be able to plan as well for any investments that will be required to reduce their emissions. And then we'll be calling for pollution prevention plans, which needs to be approved by the department before they can start implementing. And then the annual report will continue, and then compliance will kick in at the end of that cycle. The carbon budget is basically a means of regulating greenhouse gas emissions in the country. So we will be allocating an emission allowance to a particular company to say this is how much you can emit. You can't go beyond your carbon budget. And there will be a reporting system, as I indicated, and a compliance mechanism at the end of the first phase for the compliance mechanism. And we're implementing this in a phased approach manner, mainly because of lack of data at the moment, and we don't have any legal basis to come up with carbon budgets. So as we are looking towards coming up with a legal basis for this, then we'll be implementing more like your trial period. Phase one will be more like your trial period, which will start in 2016 next year. And then hopefully when you get to second phase 2021, then it will be more robust and have some legal setup. This is a picture of the mix of measures. It's also a project that is currently underway. We try to map interventions and measures and instruments that are available in the country to support emission reductions. And we've categorized them in the regulatory measures there. So there, and these are measures implemented by government and developed by government. So we're not looking at other measures that are not developed by government. An example there, category one would be a regulatory measure, and other examples we're looking at legislation, there's some standards that would have been developed by government. And the second one is economic instruments, and an example here is the carbon tax that can help you to reduce emissions. And then we have direct government interventions. For instance, if you come up with a policy in terms of procurement, today we will go for interventions that are going to reduce emissions, that are direct government action. And then there's also support measures, where government supports in different interventions in different spheres of government and the private sector, and all the other work that is done, for instance, like the South African National Energy Development Institute, which is basically looking at the research and the development of energy technologies. And then there's information programs to raise awareness on emission reduction. So that is a picture of the sort of measures that we currently have in government to reduce emissions. Some of the supporting projects and roles, the Department of GST, Science and Technology, is doing a piece of work to look at the mitigation technology plan. When we concluded the mitigation potential analysis, the question was, where can we, for instance, create new industries in terms of those technologies that have been identified in the MPA? So this piece of work, which is going to be concluded very soon, basically assesses the opportunities and barriers to the development of certain technologies and look at the potential of creating new industries and jobs in the country. The National Employment Vulnerability Assessment, it basically looks at the impact of climate change interventions on employment, and that's a piece of work that has been led by the Economic Development Department. They have just started with the project, so we don't have much to tell in terms of the outcomes of that piece of work. The socio-economic impact is a piece of work that GEA will be leading. We have just initiated this to try and understand the socio-economic impact of the mitigation work that we are doing. This is the last and final slide. The carbon tax, you hear presentation from National Treasury, they are leading piece of work on the carbon tax. And at the moment, the question is, how do you align carbon tax on your carbon budget? And we work very closely with Treasury, and we have an option presented on the table in terms of how to align instruments. And then the integrated resource plan, which is an electricity plan by the Department of Energy, which we use mainly as a basis for most of our work. That's just the assumptions that we used here were also used in the mitigation potential analysis, and the integrated energy plan, which the Department of Energy is working on. This instrument will help us, or plans will help us reduce our emissions. And all other interventions by other government departments, like the GDWP on buildings, government buildings, energy efficiency interventions, we have the energy DOE in terms of renewables. DTI, they have started implementing some of the mitigation opportunities identified, and then we have DAF for the agricultural sector on the list goes on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we go to the presentation on carbon tax, if there are any issues colleagues would like to raise on this presentation, Honorable Stana.
Thank you very much, Chair.
I just wanted to ask some questions across your presentation. The first of which, you mentioned that the implementation of the climate change mitigation strategies will have to be adopted from a provincial level. What plans do we have in place to ensure that they have the necessary capacity to do so, and how are we going to ensure that they actually, how are they going to enforce from a provincial level? What legislative framework is going to ensure that they have the enforcement capability? I also wanted to know whether the department has done a cost-benefit analysis of mitigation versus adaptation strategies, because there's debates whether one is more cost-effective than the other. I just wanted to know the department's opinion on that. Then I wanted to know whether we are negotiating in good faith ahead of the COP21 and these interim negotiations, because as we have to be realistic about our current energy crisis, about the postponements that have been given regarding compliance, about the realistic, whether it is realistic that certainly the energy sector is going to comply with retrofit and decommission of its polluting stations, the plausibility of a carbon tax actually being passed due to the possible adverse effects on business. I'm wondering, you know, are we negotiating as South Africa in good faith with these COP21s, because are we being realistic about our current situation as a country and the impact about making certain commitments? I also wanted to know...
Hold it then.
Okay.
No, thank you. I think, first of all, just one comment that the notion or the plan to have provincial climate change conferences is a step in the right direction. It has to be welcome. In the sense that you will be able to reach a lot of role players at the phase where it matters most, which is local. So 9 provinces will cover that. Welcome. But my question, I know Judy in her introductory remarks, she has attempted to give us a scenario in terms of where we are. But I want us to simplify, realistically speaking, where we are as a country in terms of greenhouse emissions. I simplified it, simply. I know this is more detailed, this is technical, but just simplify in succinctly, where are we as a country? As far as emission control. That is the first thing. We are also aware that the department has carried out a number of studies pertaining to the subject matter. But then the question that follows for me is, are we looking at the highest emission profile that we have identified for ourselves as per the long-term mitigation? As per the long-term mitigation scenario, based on the study that you've undertaken. Obviously, the second one was around carbon tax, but in terms of your direction, you want us first to finish this. I will follow up with carbon tax afterwards. Thanks. Thanks, Honorable Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. The first perhaps was regard to the subsectors. In fact, you were concerned to set us where the mitigations and all that could be done. The 5, energy, industry, transport, and all that, and sectors. You said then that there's work, that there are existing subsectors where work has not been done, necessarily because there has not been data. Now, meaning we are not able as a country to account for that. They exist. There is dry emissions, but then we're not able to deal with that. And my view will be, all I want to understand is what work is going into that, so that at some point we are able to account holistically for everything, so that we don't leave something outside of is just a right away. The second, there are those low-hanging fruit kinds of or low-emitting areas which are all at what is under zero, which can be done almost immediately and without much cost to that. Now, all I want to understand is whether government widely has that understanding that we shared with everybody and everybody agrees, and whether that, when will that be done, or is it awaiting the conclusion from EGD, which is Economic Development Department, impact analysis on what will be the cost for jobs, and or it can be done right away, even before the conclusion of that particular work. The last part is the one on the carbon budget. You're saying we don't have all the data, that's one. But second, that we're piloting that, but second, that, that there's no legal base upon which this can successfully be done. Are you saying there's need for legislation in that regard, that there's nothing that exists, so that we should be looking forward to the development of saying, or what is it? I'm not very sure. That you sort of are not able to move, because even if you were to move, there's just no legal basis on the basis of which you can do that. Or it's just regulations that needs to be done on top of that. What legal basis? And I just want to try to understand what are we talking about when we're talking legal basis, or whether there's no law that allows you to do that, or is there broad, but to pin down there's need for some regulations that need to be developed. I think you get my point. Mm-hmm. It's not answered well, I mean, come back on that one.
So, sir, at a technical level that advises government, do we have such a technical team on this? At a government-wide level, because I'm just thinking broadly, whether we should not have overstructuring also elevated to the composition of such a technical team, so that you don't have us oversighting little aspects of climate change, adaptation or mitigation. And you correctly said that there are expectations arising from the government energy plan and the other plans. There are expectations from various departments. Technical work, is there a technical unit that comprises all this? Was for us to do justice to the 50-year scenario that we have here, I think there must be some babysitting of that 50-year scenario that looks into each and every component of that scenario. Do we have such a technical team? You have correctly said, Judy, and also Chief Darrell, that indeed it would be correct for us to, as a portfolio committee, to zoom deeper into the other department and see whether they are doing their bit. But you should be knowing as a technical team, if there is a technical team, that they are doing their bit, so that when we interact with you, we have a sense of what at the technical level is happening. And again, emphasizing the point that in our implementation of our climate change response policy, structure-wise, our structure problems. Because indeed you can have wonderful policies, but if your structure is messed up, you'll not even be able to implement those policies. Indeed, you can talk to the MTF framework, you can talk to the NDP, But when on this important subject of negative impacts of climate change, it brought deliberations and discussions are left to the various entities of government to implement, you might get nowhere. And of course some of us have been in government for too long. And we know that if the various parts of government that needs to contribute meaningfully to this do not have something that ties them together, you might have a big problem on your side. The last one, what are we presenting on what? You see, we are supposed to be getting from industry their own plans, but those plans can only come after we have established the carbon budget. So those plans can only come at that stage. Where are the discussions with industry now? Because those discussions will inform the carbon budget in the first place. So those carbon budgets can't just come by themselves. And therefore, those carbon budgets inform the greenhouse gas emissions plans from industry and companies. Where are we? Because we might be all over the place and not get anywhere. On this aspect, where are we?
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps I can start, and then Deborah, you can pick up some of the more technical issues. Just to start with the question of provincial capacity, and to what extent or to what work is being put in place to ensure that there is sufficient capacity at provincial level to undertake the kind of work that is needed to be undertaken. We have just worked with provinces to do exactly that, an assessment of what capacity is in place at provincial level. Of course, at provincial level, it's not necessarily divided into the adaptation and mitigation. It is similarly at local government level. It really is about climate change response. And what is the budget allocation? What is the human resource allocation in each of the different provinces? In most cases, there certainly at this stage is not sufficient capacity. And I think the first step was to highlight the fact that increasingly there is an obligation on provinces to in particular focus on the adaptation to the impacts of climate change, because that work has to be built into their planning processes and it requires the allocation of budgets. From a national perspective, we cannot necessarily do more than raise the and give profile to firstly what are the functions that would need to be fulfilled at provincial level, and then what kind of capacity would be needed. It's the provinces would then need to do prioritization and do the budget allocation and do the human resource prioritization, and that is where we would need political support to elevate the matter. In terms of the question of mitigation versus adaptation, what is most cost effective, it is not possible to distinguish between the two, because the reality is that with the level of global emissions already built into the system, South Africa and Southern Africa is already experiencing a level of impact of climate change. And we can already see that we've got, through our National Biodiversity Institute, our South African Weather Services, and other institutes, we are tracking, for example, the reduction in the number of cold days that we are experiencing, which are needed for some of our, for the apple industry, for example. We're noticing an increasing trend in high temperatures. We've seen the increasing number of flood events. We are seeing the increasing incidence of impact in our coastal areas and damage in coastal areas, which is normally due to a combination of a high tide or typically high tide and a storm surge, but it is also due to the fact that we are slowly but surely getting sea level rise. So it is not, you cannot distinguish. South Africa has to make its contribution to the global effort of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and at the same time, we have to start allocating resources and start building into our planning processes the ability to respond to the impacts of climate change. So it really is about looking at both, and in particular, what we are trying to do is focus on where the integration is. And the integration between reducing emissions and adapting to the impact of climate change is in particular in the forestry sector and in the agriculture sector and in the nurturing of our greenhouse gas sinks. And a sink is our vegetation, for example, and the soil that absorbs greenhouse gas emissions. So by rehabilitating and restoring certain of our biodiversity systems, in particular the grasslands are important, and rehabilitating our wetlands, for example, which have an impact in terms of reducing loss of water, we're actually managing to do both. And so that is it's a double win, and we need to focus on those kinds of initiatives. The question on negotiating in good faith in terms of our energy situation, again, I think we need to distinguish between our negotiation as a global player and our efforts to ensure that Paris achieved the outcome that was called for through the Durban platform. And the outcome that is called for in the Durban platform is a new legal agreement applicable to all countries, all parties, through a multilateral process, which achieves the objective of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is that there is sufficient commitment to reduce emissions to ensure that we achieve the global temperature goal of 2 degrees. So at a global level, we are a global player with the Africa Group, with the Group of 77, to ensure that we get an outcome that addresses, that balances our development priorities with our climate change response priorities, that achieves the balance between mitigation and adaptation, that ensures that we get sufficient, as developing countries, get sufficient financial support to support the efforts, particularly in the context of Africa, which is facing at the moment, as we look, is facing a between a 3 and 5 degree temperature increase with severe food security and water security implications. So that's our role as a global player. I want to distinguish that from, I think, the point that is being raised around are we negotiating in good faith in terms of our energy situation. Now, the reality is that South Africa, with a high dependence on currencies on coal-based energy generation and therefore with quite high emissions, has a commensurate obligation to take absolutely the necessary action to reduce our emissions, acknowledging that we are operating in certain developmental contexts within which we have particular priorities around poverty eradication and economic growth. So it's about a balance. In terms of what our global contribution would be, as I said, our global unintended nationally determined contribution would be both on the adaptation side and on the mitigation side. And South Africa would not retreat. We would not retreat from our commitment that was made by President Zuma in 2009 in Copenhagen, which was the 34 and 42% reduction against business as usual by 2020 and 2025. So we put that commitment once again on the table. And what we would do in our intended nationally determined contribution is demonstrate what South Africa is putting in place in order to move us towards achieving that aspirational commitment. And as I said, the focus in the adaptation part of our INDC is to demonstrate to the world the kind of costs and investments that South Africa has already made in terms of adapting to the impact of climate change and the kind of cost and investments that we envisage over the next 10, 20, 30 and 40 years. And as soon as our discussion document is finalised, we really look forward to presenting that to the committee. In terms of the question about what in a simple way, I think with the Honourable Mbilo, the real, just in simplified terms, what is our African situation in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions? Well, if I'd been able to quickly upload the slide, I would have been able to show the slide, but we need to talk to it, and I can forward the information to you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. But the greenhouse gas inventory from 2000 to 2010 demonstrated that our current greenhouse gas emissions are 544 million tons. That's where we are. We are at 544, which represent between 2000 and 2010, our emissions increased by 21%. So that's between 2000 and 2010. In a 10-year period, our emissions increased by 21%. The major driving elements or the drivers for this increase is associated with a 27% increase in energy emissions, largely from power stations and combustion installations in our big industry sites, for example, an increase in road transportation emissions, an increase in emissions from waste, those are the three major drivers. Now, if we compare that, and I think this is probably what Honourable Leader was looking for, if we compare that with what the range is in terms of our peak, plateau, and decline emission, benchmark emission trajectory range, which is international policy, you'll recall that it's not just a line that we are trying to meet. We add a range, an upper range and a lower range, so that we have flexibility, we have space within which to demonstrate that, of course, our emissions are still going up, but they will at some point going down, can't start coming down. And the range, the top of the range in 2020 is 583 megatons. So if you compare, if you compare the 583 with the 544, which is where our emissions are currently, remember that the 583 is a 2020 number. That's the top of the range for the 2020 number. So the reality is, Honourable Mavila, that we are quite tight. The 2025 number is 614 megatons. So 614. So, and those numbers are in the National Climate Change Response Policy. The range is in the policy. I can even give you page 27 of the National Climate Change Response Policy. The published version. Those numbers are detailed there. But we're currently doing our next version of our greenhouse gas emission inventory, which would be the 2012 emission inventory. It's always difficult to get the latest numbers because it's a process of analysing, getting hold of the latest data from industry. We work with industry very closely to to receive their information, their data on to be able to do the calculations and the analysis on our greenhouse gas inventory. So we're always about 2 or 3 years behind, two years behind in terms of which data we were using and where we are, what we're actually reporting in our greenhouse gas inventory. The 2012 inventory will be available next year. Inventory, so 2012 inventory will be available next year. I think, Deborah, if there's anything additional that you might want to add on to that. I think then, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, Deborah will deal with some of the technical issues, but I would like to just respond to the point about how we coordinate and whether there's a technical team to advise government, and how one facilitates that oversight across the different government departments. So I think the reality is that each department works with technical advisors within the scope of the particular program that they are leading. So the Department of Energy has their set of advisors for their integrated resource plan and their integrated energy plan. The Department of Transport has their set of advisors for their transport work, etc. We have a set of advisors that have been working with us on, firstly, on the mitigation potential analysis, and then on the process for defining conceptualizing the mitigation system. Where all of that comes together is through the Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change. And the Intergovernmental Committee has representation mostly at the level of director and chief director. So I think that one can call that it's a technical team, and then that technical team reports into the MINTEC structure, which is our DG plus the heads of department of province plus the DGs of sector departments. And then it reports also into the economic cluster, which is the DGs of sector departments, and reports to MINTEC. So there is a reporting structure, Honourable Chair. I think, though, that the point that you were driving at in terms of an oversight level that cuts across the different sectors would be something that would certainly support the work that we are trying to do, because this really is about, this work is about political prioritization, it's about coordination, it's about integration, and it's about providing, allocating the necessary budget. I think the last point I would just like to address is the question of the legal basis, Honourable Makubela, and Debra will come in here in addition. Just to say that in a system that we're designing, as Debra showed you in the cycle, there's the carbon budgeting and the carbon tax, which is one element of the system. There's the pollution prevention plans, which is the second element. There's the reporting, the mandatory reporting, which is the third element, and then measuring and evaluation. And obviously, there's the technical work that has to be done up front, where we are working with the Department of Energy using their integrated resource plan and doing our own further technical mitigation potential analysis. Now the question is, what is the legal basis for all of those elements of the system that we're building? And at the moment, in absence of a designated piece of legislation, we are using the legislation that we have at our disposal. So, for example, we are using the Air Quality Act, we're using the Air Quality Act for two of those elements. The first element we're using is Section 89, and that's for the pollution prevention plan. And the second part is where we're using the regulatory making procedures for the mandatory reporting. So there's a legal basis for those two elements of the system. And then the Department of Finance and Treasury will be presenting on the regulations that they are intending to promulgate for a carbon tax. The question, however, is what legal basis for carbon budgeting? And we have looked at various options. And in view of our efforts to get the first phase of the system in place by the 1st of January 2016, at this stage there is not a ready legal instrument, a ready legal tool that we can use in order to give the carbon budget a legal basis. In our view, that does not stop the process. That does not have an impact for establishing the system, which consists of all of its elements, but what we are working towards is a piece of legislation that would be able to consolidate all of these elements into a single piece of legislation. I think possibly Debra might want to to add to that. And I think there's a couple of other issues.
Okay. The questions that you left out, the issue of data gaps. Draft regulations which have just been published for stakeholder consultation will address that. So as soon as it becomes mandatory for companies to submit data, then we will close those gaps in terms of data gaps. So when we update the MPA in the future, we will be able to get that data from companies. At the moment, it's more like a gentleman's argument in terms of getting data. It's even more of a challenge now when we have to allocate carbon budgets, that we now need to send letters to companies to request them to submit data, because there's no mandatory instrument that says submit data to the department. The issue on negative costs, what are we doing now? We're working with land departments to try and get them to implement, for instance, the Department of Trade and Industries through their National Cleanup Action Center. They've established a forum where they can look at some of the opportunities that have been identified in the mitigation potential analysis to be implemented in different sectors. And as I indicated, some of the lowest hanging fruits, for instance, in the commercial and residential needs to be implemented, some by the DPW in government buildings. And there's a flagship that the department is working with DPW on efficiency of government buildings. That's about it.
That's on this one. When is it commencing? Are we just saying people know they will start, and it's just up to them when they keep starting this thing, or there's a particular agreed date? First of all, yeah, whatever, but by this time, all the low hanging fruits, government work across government structure and so on, either by public ways or whatever, will start.
We don't have timelines for implementation of those. We push most of them through the leadership programs, which we're still working on, and you can add on that, which is outside my portfolio.
That's why I asked this question. Until give us that structure, your structure in government, then we will concoct our own structure, which will then finish it and oversight the structure. Because until we are able to sit together with a portfolio committee on energy, portfolio committee on transport, portfolio committee on public works, all this, so that we then say, now we are dealing with this issue, where are we? On climate change. Now we are dealing with this issue. Until we are able to do that, so Judy can't answer all these questions. She can understand. But we need action plans from these departments that are party to our climate change response policy. Until we have that parliamentary structure that is overarching, we will talk and talk and talk and get nowhere.
Yes, indeed, Honourable Chair, that is. I think just to add on the question of so what is happening, for example, on the obvious low-hanging fruit that was demonstrated there, energy efficiency in public buildings. It is directly within the realm and reach of government departments at national, provincial, and local level. It's a climate change response flagship that is being done through a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Public Works, Department of Energy, and ourselves. It has started with the support of donor funding and the establishment of an energy efficiency fund, which enables provinces and local government to access the upfront funding and cost, or these upfront funding that is needed to start that process of doing the necessary retrofits, whether it's changing the globes, changing the air conditioning systems, doing whatever kind of retrofitting is needed to reduce energy efficiency in public buildings. I mean, the reality is that we are looking at thousands and thousands and thousands of public buildings, and there are pilot projects that have been initiated, and together with Public Works, the intention is to aim for the first 10,000 buildings within the next 3 years. Now that is quite an ambitious exercise. It requires allocation of budget. We cannot persist on donor funding. And also requires the necessary institutional capacity to be in place to make that a reality. But it is part of the call and the response to President Zuma's energy efficiency campaign and the contribution to reducing energy load in the country. So that is one example. There are, you know, some of the other examples of the renewable energy independent power producing program has just called for the fourth window, it just advertised the or called for the fourth window, announced.
Through the minister's designation, then the Minister of Energy is going to negotiate for a fifth window, which they look into close about 700 megawatts of renewable energy. She still needs to remember the concurrence between herself and NESA. So she still needs to negotiate with NESA to find where they want to get money for the second question. It depends on giving the guarantee for the
So I think that there is a clear time frame and a clear program of action from the Department of Energy in terms of the fourth and the fifth window of renewable energy CCPs. I would be able to provide the time frames of the other programs that are situated and the targets that are situated within the medium term strategic framework, and what we know about some of the programs that are being led by other departments. But I think just to say that we don't at this stage have a fully articulated national plan that outlines exactly what is being delivered by which department at which time. We have elements of that national plan, elements that are in the medium term strategic framework, elements that are in that are being done or led or catalyzed through the climate change response flagship program, and then elements that we have direct responsibility for leading. Thanks.
Colleagues, can you allow me to direct that we get the presentation on current health, then it can go to every country and everything else, after, so that we don't miss this presentation. Let's get the presentation and we can then come to any other questions that we might have raised. Carbon health presentation? Oh, representative is not here. Oh, okay, then we can decide it. Okay.
On slide 8, you refer to the sensitivity analysis that was done on the low economic growth of 3.8%. Now, currently in the last 3 years, we've seen our country growing between 1 and 2% thereabouts. So I'm just concerned about how an even lower economic growth would impact the country as well as business ability to implement emission reduction strategies. And I just wanted to find out if you could further explain the reference case of assuming no mitigation and the impact of current mitigation strategies. So that's the first question. Just want to understand those figures at the bottom of page of slide 8 a little bit better. Then the three cycles that you are planning to or provide business with so that they can provide their or so that they can conduct their planning. Now, if it's my understanding that each cycle is of 5 years, and I'm wondering if three cycles or 15 years is sufficient for business to do long-term planning, especially considering that we're coming from a base where we have a lot of catch-up to do. It's very interesting that you talk about legislation and a regulatory framework that is somewhat disjointed, and also that there isn't a fully integrated, articulate national plan. Because one of the concerns is that, number one, environment and those kinds of things are seen as not urgent, not for today, you know, something that's only going to, the sky will only fall in 20 years' time rather than, you know, some of the burning issues that are facing us today, and it keeps getting pushed on the back burner. And we've seen the departments contravene its own legislation in terms of the air quality management framework when it granted postponements in already declared hotspot areas. We see industry, polluters, bullying government to say, no, we're not going to implement certain things, or we just can't, and it's because of this, that, and anything. When can we see a fully integrated national plan with legislation, with peace, that the Department of Environmental Affairs and government have to jointly agree to, that it's not going to back down and say, okay, well, you know, the energy sector has spoken. What are your plans to, A, develop that plan, and when, and also with regarding to a consolidated piece of legislation that can actually tackle this problem properly and effectively. The other thing that I wanted to know is more about the dynamic between the carbon budget and carbon tax. It was one of the slides. There isn't a slide number, but this, yes, correct. Aligning the carbon budget and the carbon tax. I just wanted to get more information about that dynamic. And your mitigation technology plan. Now, currently we are seen as a country that is heavily reliant on its natural resources, and we do a lot of export of raw material. What we should be seeing is a government shift of actually moving and creating these new industries like you spoke of, Mr. Beaumont, about actually creating green energy and shifting our skill sets, our government support, the finance, you know, our IDCs and National Treasury, those kinds of things. What are we doing to move South Africa toward a green economy so that we can see that we are utilizing those raw materials and converting them into finished products, but also that in the green sector there are so many new opportunities. Because, for example, coal is a dead-end resource. Okay, the quality is getting poorer and it's going to run out one day. Whereas if we as a country decided to shift our economy to renewable, sustainable industries, they would replace and create new opportunities for investment, development, jobs, etc. So in terms of that mitigation technology plan, I just want to find out exactly, you know, what the approach is and see whether it is as it should be. Thank you.
Just on the basis for activities is 84 and 42% decrease in greenhouse gas emissions 2020 and 2025. Where are the discussions with industry now? Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. On the basis of moving away from business as usual. And probably that's what Mabila was asking. Locating this discussion within that date for, because we are doing a catch up here to come to 34% come 2020. Where are we in the reductions? Come 2020, from we are now sitting at 544 million tons. Of course, we expect that in terms of your scenario. But again, that going up is located within the moving away from business as usual. Even though we might go up to 614 sometime in 2025, but we will not have been there. So if we can get, how does that link with the divorce? Even our going up, how does that link with the 34% of reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from business as usual? And locate whatever numbers within this. If we are unable to, no problem at all, we can come back later if we have not prepared for it now. Of course, the other reality is that we might not have recent data. But if you can speak to them, that will assist us with it. But where are the discussions with industry? Though we might not have a legal framework, we agree, but we can use our pollution law to give effect to this for industry to report on their pollution on the greenhouse gas. But where are we now? Have we met with all industry? Have we met with all sectors of industry? And because of that, amongst other things, should be what informs these three negotiations at Bonn. Our interaction with our people. I mean, we cannot just be having this good idea as government and only to find that this idea might not be that acceptable to our partners, very important partners in the industry. Where are we now on the crafting of our national determined contributions as agreed in COP20?
Thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I think again, I'll pick up some of the more cross-cutting issues, and then Deborah will pick up the more detailed points. The Honourable Chair, I think just to start with your question of where are we in terms of engaging industry. It's important, again, just to distinguish between engaging in terms of our position in the international negotiations and engaging on our intended nationally determined contribution, because it's two quite distinct processes. In terms of, the provincial conferences are starting straight after Bonn, so that'll be, the first one will be towards the end of June, and then they'll go through June, July, August, and September. The first draft of our discussion document for our intended nationally determined contribution, or the discussion document, not the first draft, but the discussion document will be available by around the 19th to 20th of June. We have a first draft that there's the additional information that we need, particularly on the adaptation part of it. And so that discussion document industry will be one of the organizations that we will immediately engage with.
We hear that the chairman from Treasury recently has an appointment with some people overseas. Now, we wouldn't like to rush him, because at any rate, there's been a lot that we need to cover on this, before we come to carbon tax. I think we can stick to the generalities around carbon tax, but maybe presentation now we can allow you to say, you see, that's a good thing of being a chair. And I know that you are dealing with your own portfolio committee. Now you must rush over this. Now, again, it will not do justice for you to just present in a hurry. Because I know these members, they can ask you questions the whole day and the whole night. Rest assured, we will call you. Yeah, we will make arrangements with the department and also with the Minister of Finance that you come at some appropriate time. And so I think for now we can release it so that you are able to go to wherever you need to go to. But thank you for coming. Thank you. Julian?
Yeah, Julian, you can continue.
No, continue. No, he has to rush somewhere else.
Until
12.
45 minutes.
Oh, then stop you. I thought that you needed to leave now.
No.
Oh, then speak to, if you don't mind, then maybe you can just do the presentation. Okay, then in that case, the platform is yours, then, sir.
We will come back for all those questions.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to put you for the company changing the finances of science. on the carbon tax proposals, how much is somebody operating the slide or can I come and operate it myself?
Somebody is.
Okay. Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity. We really appreciate to share with you some of our work we've done on the carbon tax. And we have worked on this very closely with the Department of Environmental Affairs. So the first slide just gives you an outline of some of the issues that I will touch on. I'm not going to go into detail on that. The second slide clearly contextualizes the whole debate on the carbon tax, carbon price. We take our cue in the particular instance from the climate change white paper and to the specific objective of the climate white paper saying that we effectively manage the inevitable climate change impact through intervention as well as sustainable we are quite aware of that objective. And then secondly, which is sometimes the one that a lot of people say why we do this, but I think we can everyone to make a fair contribution to global efforts to save our greenhouse gas. Here some people say China and the U.S. Emissions are 5 times, 6 times better than Africa. Why should such an effort? I think the Department of Environmental Affairs is nice to conceptualize the role that South Africa should play. Within the white papers, they also reference to lots of issues, but one specific reference is to the use of carbon pricing to deal and make contributions towards mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. So that's really the fundamental policy departure point. The next slide deals with a couple of issues, and I think we've mentioned this already, Chair, that I actually made this commitment at COP15 in 2009 to reduce our emissions by 54.2%, and obviously as we on the course of the slide, that commitment will be visited or be stated at the Paris meeting later this year. Important that as a developing and emerging economy that we should not forget that we are sitting with major challenges around economic growth and job creation and poverty reduction. And so in our efforts to deal with other challenges like environmental challenges, we can't ignore the need for us to grow this economy. So there's a need for a balance to approach. And for me, that is the kind of departure that we have taken for developing and transforming. A well-known industrialist in the USA has made a very important point to say, traditionally people have seen getting to economic growth and environmental challenges as trade-offs. And he makes the point, I'd just like to agree with this point, he said, the choice and then the trade-off we are told that we should make between financial success and environmental success, between doing well and doing good, are playing false. So that is important. Change in the thinking of many people and also many people. The next slide shows you something that you're probably much aware of. It's updated data, but it shows you that Africa emissions are not intermittent. We are in the top 20 in terms of absolute emissions. We are hitting around about 1 to 1.5% of emissions. The next slide, after this one, shows you that on a per capita basis, Africa is also on the high side. So therefore, it's important that we do not take this important challenge lightly. The next slide is a slide produced by the Department of Environmental Affairs. And I think this is good, sort of a slide that we work on. But this is the greenhouse gas emissions by sector, by main sectors as of 2010. And this shows you the importance of the energy sector, which in South Africa when it comes to issues. Eskom being the main player, and then obviously the finding industry, transporting, and the other people that are and then obviously there are issues in various other areas, specifically in better areas like cement and steel production. So it's a thing of what I'm not saying. The next slide, to me, summarizes some of the challenges the world faces, and this is just one of many points. The World Bank released a report in 2011 around the importance of work that has been done to deal with alleviating poverty, but it expressed the concern that if we don't address the challenge of climate change and greenhouse emissions, it will result in us reversing the gains that we've made as a world to the countries more dealing with climate change. The next slide, as you hear again, people are very selective when they try to argue, but the National Development Plan plays an important aspect that covers the whole issue of moving towards a green economy. And in the National Plan, I just quoted a few quotes from it. They indicated also the importance to get our economy on a low carbon trajectory, and also the importance that a carbon price can play. And I just wanted to go into the details of those quotes. There, I'm sure there's a lot more in the plan itself that you can plug. From an economic point of view, and slide the following slide contextualize the challenges that we face in the environmental space about externalities. By externalities, from the economic point of view, is that we do things, and those things sometimes have consequences that we don't pay for, or we benefit from things that we don't pay for, and those are called externalities. And so there are negative externalities and positive externalities. And the problem with the environmental areas that we pay, a lot of the things that we do is not properly priced into the products that we consume. And therefore, you need to have various interventions to price those externalities. Now, how to do this? Next slide tells you there are basically broad two categories. You can either regulate, which is what the Department of Environmental Affairs likes to do, and that we call sort of some languages command control. You say to a firm, you shall not do this, or you can't use asbestos, or you can't use that particular material, or you have to keep your emissions below a certain level, otherwise this will happen. The other approach is to have a market-based approach, to try and intervene to price externality. These are two extreme approaches, but they're not necessarily incompatible. They can complement one another, and in some instances, the one might be better than the other. For example, in the case of asbestos, as a country and as a world, we say we're going to ban use of asbestos, we can't do it because the consequences of using asbestos is just to die. There you use the command and control measures. On other measures, you use a combination of the two. And in the entire space area, that is probably the part we follow. Next slide then shows you the rationale why a carbon price is important. This is a quote from, I think, an Australian document, but it's various other documents that makes the same point. Carbon tax is a means by which government can intervene by way of market-based instruments to appropriately take into account the social costs resulting in carbon emissions. The carbon tax seeks to level the playing field between carbon-intensive and low-carbon emitting economies. And then the last bullet point, the introduction of a carbon price will change the relative prices of goods and services, making emission-intensive goods more expensive relative to those that are less emission-intensive, and provides a powerful incentive for consumers and businesses to judge the behavior resulting in emission reduction. And this is really the fundamental policy principles of using a carbon price. The next slide shows you a graph which is quite familiar. People have used this type of graph in various areas. So this is a chart that comes from the International Energy Agency. And then at the point that you see the blue colored area, they talk about an economy-wide carbon price that you need that is modest but change behavior. And then on the left side, you see sort of pinkish oval color saying there are certain activities that are cost-effective
But that doesn't happen because the upfront cost might be high, and therefore you need some incentive to encourage people to do it, although people do it because it's in their own benefit and it's a negative cost. On the extreme side, there are certain things that is very difficult to do, but it's important to try and encourage them, and there you need more interventions, more incentives like carbon capture and storage, research and development, and so on. So there's a host of mix of measures that you need to apply. The next one I'd say then, there are two concerns when you price externalities, and okay, carbon price is one of them. One is the distribution concern. How does your intervention impact on households, and specifically poor households, and how to mitigate the impact on poor households? One should upfront acknowledge this is a possibility and put in measures to deal with it. In the case of climate change, one must always bear in mind, as the quote from the World Bank indicated, that a lot of the people that are actually negatively affected by climate change are the poor people. And therefore, you need to consider that. The second big issue that is raised by many people are issues of competitiveness. And here, business obviously lobbies very hard. The next slide, please. And say, how does this impact on our competitiveness? So other countries don't price carbon, how do we deal with it to make sure there's level playing field? And in the policy paper that we published in 2007, we tried to address those issues also. And there's various ways one can do that. And one of the important ways is to have a fairly long transition period. You don't do things overnight, you give people a chance to adjust. The next slide shows you one of the measures. This is not the ideal one, but one of the measures that a couple of countries are talking about is what they call carbon tax adjustments or border tax adjustments. Is that you impose then an import duty on goods imported from countries that don't price carbon. And this is a retaliating measure, which is not a preferable one, but there is a common thing that they will consider. The next slide just gives you a historical path that we have followed today and how we have developed the carbon tax policy in terms of the fiscal reform paper that we published way back in 2006, the long-term mitigation scenario that the Department of Environmental published, and how we've incorporated that in developing a carbon tax discussion paper which we published in 2010. The Department of Environmental Affairs published the white paper in 2011. We then followed this up with carbon tax policy paper in 2013. That was followed up with the carbon offset paper. And we're now in the process of aligning the carbon tax with the carbon budget. And that was one of the questions that were raised. I'll try to answer that later on. And then obviously, we hope to have draft legislation, and with your support and our committee support, try and get this draft legislation through cabinet this year with the intention to implement the carbon tax by mid next year. I'm going to briefly highlight some of the comments that we've received. This is very high level summary of the comments. Next slide, that some people have raised concerns, others have suggested some amendments, but there's a few people that still deny climate change is an issue, but they're in a minority. But they've got loud voice, and that's what you see in presence. Then the next slide shows you briefly the design of the carbon tax. We proposed a carbon tax at 120 rand per ton, but because we acknowledge the need to make sure the transition is smooth, we provide significant relief during the first phase. And so the tax-free allowance of 60% that can increase up to 90% in the discussion with the Department of Environmental Affairs, up to 95%. Then people ask ourselves, always ask, what do you do with the revenue? Does it go into this big pot of treasury, government, and you make the money?
Mm-hmm.
And we make the point that our budget process is very transparent, and all allocations are done by Parliament, and so there is not this big black box that there is this misallocation of resources. We are not in favor of full earmarking revenue, and there's various reasons why not, but we made a commitment that resources will be changed to various initiatives, some of them I've listed here, they're like the energy efficiency, and also the department in the white paper a number of flagship projects, and that is all being developed. So that's the next slide just gives in words what the graph is basically saying to you. and I think I'll skip that one. Next two slides just talks about the admin stuff. How does this base work? How will the text be collected? And we work very closely with the department on the greenhouse gas inventory, and the greenhouse gas inventory will be a very important reference source for the administration of the climate taxes. Okay, skip the next slide. Then the issue of bank revenue recycling, as I indicated in the earlier graph, there are various ways to do that. You can do it with tax shifting, meaning you reduce other taxes. One proposal is to reduce, for example, electricity levy and provide some incentives. The next slide goes into a little more detail on some of the business incentives and also what do we do with electricity sector. Some people say there's already an implicit carbon price in the renewable energy project. How do you deal with that? So we said we completely. The next slide goes back and try and talk to the competitiveness issues. And I said we have taken that on board, and we have a proposal how to deal with it, provide some additional relief for businesses. And then the important slide that follows this one is our attempt to align the carbon tax with the carbon budget. We had many discussions with the department, and I think the, I'm not sure, Julia, I will end some of the questions that you answered, but the important point is that during the first phase, the carbon tax will be the lead instrument, the carbon budget being an important tool that the department will develop, and how to incentivize companies to provide information to the department to develop the carbon budget, and there we are satisfied. Then there's a few slides on the carbon offset mechanism, how the carbon offset scheme will work. This is pretty closely linked to the thinking on the CDM type of projects, where companies can invest in other projects and get some credits to reduce their tax liability. This takes us a step closer to an emission trading system, which I don't think the country is ready for it yet, but maybe in future the country might be ready for an emission trading system. Some people have got some more problems with the emission trading system. We don't have it, but I think we've got a more of an institutional challenge with the emission trading system. So we do explore this. We envisage that the Department of Energy will play an important role in the administration of the carbon offset, because the designated entity or authority that deals with CDM sits with the Department of Energy at the moment, the Northern Department of Energy. Then there's a few slides that follows this. You can skip this slide and skip that also. And there's a few slides, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one, but there are various studies that have modeled the impact of the carbon tax on the economy. These studies dated to studies before we actually put the carbon tax on the table. So the next slide gives you a study of the type of studies that were undertaken. Five studies that were undertaken. There's now another study that we've also launched to better more or less the design of the carbon tax. All of them indicate that the carbon tax or the carbon price can play a role to reduce emissions. They acknowledge that it might impact the economic growth negatively, but the important point there is that how you use the revenue is fundamentally important to make sure that you mitigate that and you get a win-win outcome in the end. And so these are the high-level conclusions of these studies. Some other studies take a more pessimistic view, but I think if you look at and read through all of them, the result is not as negative as some people suggest. And that really, you can skip through all of those slides. Yeah, and those slides to summarize them. Maybe you can still on this slide. This is a study that is not yet made public. It's a study that we commissioned with the assistance from money from the World Bank that we are incorporating working with the department. And this study indicates also that the current design will help reduce emissions by around about 35, between 35 and 45% by 2035. It will probably have an impact on the economy, but if you then recycle the revenue, you can mitigate that and have a more sustainable profile. And we hope to have this study available by the end of July. We make that available to all of you. Then in conclusion, Chair, The policy development and public consultation with regard to the carbon price or carbon tax are applicable from around about 2010. The climate paper was published in 2011, my apologies, so it's right there. Provided broadly the context for the carbon tax as one of the instruments. Concerns about the impact on higher electricity prices and how it impacts on households and international competitiveness are important, and we need to address that. Very important also to say that a lot has happened around the world. China has been experimenting with a carbon emission trading system. Mexico, Chile are among the countries that are introducing carbon pricing mechanisms, and many other developed countries have done. And so the last point that which I said earlier on, we will be submitting the carbon tax to the cabinet within the next month or so, and we hope to process that during the parliament process before the end of this year. Thank you.
Good. Any takers on the number one?
Thank you, Chair. On the question of externalities, who is going to conduct the studies and who should bear the cost of those studies? Then in terms of the carbon offsetting, often carbon offsetting is manipulated by industry to say, you know, that certain things are being offset when actually the status quo is being maintained. How is the cost of the offset measures going to be measured against the actual mitigation of reduction emission strategies? I hope you understand my question. And I want to find out what Treasury's plans are to lead the transition of South Africa from a carbon economy to a green economy. What plans has in that respect? Thank you.
I just have got one question. If my memory serves me well, I do have a sense that carbon tax in some countries or generally does attract some controversy. There may be a lot in terms of this presentation that is not necessarily being said. Can you share with us what are those difficulties? Why should the other countries instead decide to move away from carbon tax? What could be the disadvantages? And so on. Just for you to give us a total picture of, yes, this is what we are doing in the country and we're moving towards that, but these are the difficulties experienced elsewhere, and probably so that we'll be able to take an informed decision as we proceed, be assured that confidently this is the way to go.
Yeah.
No, thanks. I think the world has taken one of the questions that I was going to ask around one country called Australia, which is abandoning the carbon tax. My question is linked to the question. That's the first one. Now, on slide 18, you are outlining the progress of carbon tax policy proposal from 2007 to 2011. You are going to until the carbon tax implementation action in 2016. The question that I want to pose to you, sir, is that you know that carbon tax has been postponed in the country for a long time. Now, once you check this time frame of 2016, is it definite? And that's the first question. Secondly, if we implement the carbon tax in 2016, is it going to be implemented in its original form as outlining the carbon tax policy proposal? Or will it be reintroduced for implementation of the necessary modification? Now, I've gone through some issues around carbon tax. Besides carbon tax, the question that I want to know is that there are certain existing bodies in the country, for example, in the fuel lane, among others. Now, the question is that where the study is conducted to assess the impact of carbon tax on existing levies, and if so, what were the results of those studies? Thank you very much, but this was very informative. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Just one question that we have asked. Can we continue implementation of carbon tax outside of clarity on carbon budgets?
Thank you, Chief. Thanks also for the very useful question. The externality study has been done. There's lots of work that has been done to estimate what is the cost of externalities. And those are sort of range from academic literature to the work that North Stern has done. So those studies are available. So we're not going to redo a study on externalities. That work has already been done. So we know more or less that there is some difference. The studies obviously show a very wide range of estimated costs, and they all are indicative. But I think the science of climate change tells you that irrespective of the actual voluntary participation of the externality, the consequences of climate change are significant, and those are also important. So that work has been done. But as I indicated to you, it's a very local type of exercise. It's the impact of a carbon price and climate change at the local level. And those studies directly initiated one, and I showed you some of the results there. And directly now also with part of the environmental group initiated another study with the assistance of the World Bank, and I hope that report will be available by the end of July. So I hope that answers the question. The second question of carbon offsetting. Yes, I think carbon offsets can be problematic in terms of administration, but we have fairly rigorous requirements of how this will be monitored. We will work closely with the two departments, environmental affairs and the Department of Energy to ensure their sustainability. There's an option that works and it's augmented to the carbon. What Treasury is doing, I think in terms of the environmental fiscal reform agenda that we started in 2016, when we published the first paper, is an indication that the Treasury has worked face and in hand with the department to try and deal with various environmental challenges. And we introduced the plastic bag levy to try and reduce the use of plastic bags. And without a doubt, it has been a success. Obviously, there is an intention maybe to completely ban plastic bags in the future, but that's a different effect. So the carbon pricing, the plastic bags really made a major impact. We also introduced a levy on international light bulbs, trying to encourage people to start using the newer technologies. We introduced a very modest carbon tax on motor vehicles. People question whether it's working or not. I think the evidence is clear that if you up that price significantly more, it will make people choose better. Obviously, the tax at the moment is relatively modest, but obviously the carbon tax will replace that and as a more comprehensive instrument. So those are the other area that I think which is not a tax issue, but in terms of procurement, the government needs to look at its procurement policy and something more green procurement. But I'm not the expert to talk about procurement. I will leave that to my other colleagues to talk about. The issue of carbon tax being controversial, I think that is a given. Any tax is controversial. Carbon tax so much more because climate change is a global phenomenon. And if you, for as long as you don't have a global agreement, a global tax, it becomes very difficult. And therefore, you have things like border tax adjustments to try and make sure you have all the playing fields. But Africa has made a commitment through the UNFCCC process to work towards this global agreement. And I think really can say more that one hope that the Paris scheme will be a bit of a step closer towards some sort of global agreement. But that doesn't mean we should have certain ways and do nothing. problem is certainly you wait for nothing. You wake up one day and you will be able to say one thing, but then you are forced to do something that you are not prepared. Australia, like the US, are very ideological. You have a very extreme political environment in Australia and in the US. In the US, the right-wing Republicans and the urban believers in the church, and therefore they don't see the reconciliation. The administration currently are struggling to convince them that we need to take action, and they do take action, but in a different way. Australia's Prime Minister, a climate denialist, and therefore he too has to keep it secret. I think it's fair to say that Australia is still committed towards dealing with climate change. They've got other measures, which is very more costly for them. And I have no doubt in future Australia will probably move back to something potentially more efficient. But it's a political choice. But that doesn't mean they don't do anything. There are a lot of other measures that actually are costing them a lot more. Other countries, like I said, Mexico, Chile, China, are taking small steps towards the 2016 August has committed to the major crisis. 2016 is the end of implementation. It is now up to Parliament. We're going to the committee, we're going to our committee later this year, with your support, the committee support government, we get politicians to approve. So a lot of the policy ground work has been done is now really up to Parliament. The paper in 2013 provides a basic framework. We had consultations, and we had consultations with the party. So there might be small modifications, but the modifications will be enhanced through the administration and the whole infrastructure of the post framework has been developed. The fuel levy, and I think as I mentioned, the public environmental temperature that you're on, we think that you make a the fuel levy is not an environmental tax originally, but it does play a role to deal with environmental issues, and it's very effective. If you take, and our fuel levy is relatively more than compared to our countries, we just pick up on the property tax. Although we are quite a little bit this year, it's still worse compared to many other countries. And it does shift people's behavior, because if you make fuel a lot more cheaper, it's just a lot more. The tax is really playing a role. Although the tax is not the only, you can't rely only on the tax. The last question is, can we implement the carbon tax? Can we continue to I think our discussion was in the past would be that for the first 5 years, carbon tax will be the leading in trying to do mitigation. The carbon budget is evolving. I think they're going to get information from companies to develop carbon budgets. And what we have indicated that when you go to the second phase, you could convert to very current relative thresholds. You can convert it into an absolute threshold. That absolute threshold can be bottom size of the carbon budget. That's one possibility. The other possibility would be to move to an emission trading scheme completely, like start the VAT and use the carbon budget just as an indicative monitoring mechanism rather than as an instrument of payment. So those are the options that I think the South Korean Republic are much more interested in. So my understanding is that South Korea also had initial carbon budget, they couldn't have it, but they use it as a monitoring mechanism. They now, their main instrument is the emission trading.
Thank you, Chair. With regards to the externalities, what I was specifically speaking about is that the impact of lung disease, land degradation, water pollution, all of those has a cost on our national expenditure. And I was wondering how that was taken into consideration when determining a the carbon tax of 120 rand per metric ton. And then my second question is that I understand that there's no earmarking, and I'm still interested to hear why there's no ring fencing. And you mentioned the plastic levy, and we see as many plastic bags around. Perhaps, yes, there would be less, but our population has increased, and waste has certainly been identified as a key contributing area. But without imposing either conditions for that expenditure, we see companies like Eskom who keep getting bailouts and but fail to maintain or implement retrofits on these coal-powered stations. So the national fiscus will be getting a significant increase in its revenue, but how is that actually going to translate into reduced emissions and a safer, cleaner environment for our people?
We can answer what you can answer in some questions about the department.
Okay, I think again, if you look into the future, there are various attempts to estimate the cost to the district for all of these events, being climate change or local pollution issues. I think that the co-benefit is people use data of a carbon price. It doesn't only help to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it also helps to reduce other emissions, like local emissions. And so there is that benefit that you get. Where do you put a level compared to what the cost is created? Because, like for example, an area that we work on is alcohol taxation. Now, people argue that maybe you should put up the alcohol tax even higher because the cost of alcohol, the social cost of alcohol is high. But the tax can only play a role after a limit because there are unintended consequences like illicit trade, things like that. So you must be very careful not to overplay the role that taxes can play. So yes, the other constraints, the very modest other constraints, doesn't cover all the costs of the externality. But you have to begin somewhere, and you have to make a decision slowly. You can't do it overnight. So if you want to fully price all externalities at once, that other trend would probably not be 1,000. But it's impossible for us to start on the yes, the plastic bag has played a role. I think the department will tell you more about what they do towards dealing with recycling is not something successful, it's not where it is. And this is where Treasury comes in. Treasury will say, we will allocate money and you must come with a sound business case. I'm not talking about the allocation side. But you can't just ring fence money and say people can spend the money as well. There has to be accountability and there has to be benchmarks on how you can perform. And that's another Treasury concern. And so even on this type of revenue, I think it's up to Parliament again to make sure that the money is allocated for the right purposes, but it's also in use for it. And so I think there's a lot more work to be done to not only with the factory that they on Eskom, I will
pass maybe if for whatever reason you have got to leave whilst we are still here, and let's thank you. Yeah, I know that you have been to another committee of parliament, also made the effort to come here. Mr. Martin, we really appreciate that. Of course, we are not even your committee, by the way. You don't account to us. And that is the point that we're making, by the way, before you came in, that there needs to be an overarching role of parliament overseeing all matters of climate change. An overarching role that includes all the various, so that you don't have to come to us very soon. You have to go to energy, go to, you know, there must be some overarching mechanism on these cross-cutting matters. And this is what we are thinking about as Parliament. How best can we assess such a structural change so that Parliament again should be able on its own to say, this is what we have contributed on this matter of climate as Parliament, not as some little committees, environment there, energy there, transport there, party right there, finance there. In our view, we think we can do our job much better if there is this soundtrack between the various components of Parliament on oversighting this matter. But of course, we would like to really thank you for making yourself available. Just say thanks, Minister. When I meet him, I tell him now in the house. Thank you very much. And what's the name of your work there? You do with tax. The tax. I'm going to reduce our tax as Parliament.
Thank you for the invitation.
We
really appreciate it. And I really appreciate your effort to try and coordinate. And I think when the carbon tax goal comes, it would be great if the committee can meet together.
Yeah.
On your request for reduction in tax liabilities, I don't think there's any
possibility. Okay, that's not on a lighter note. Believe there were questions that were on the table. Now we are back in the firing line.
Thank you, Chair. You were asking where we were in the consultation with industry in terms of our intended nationally determined contribution, and we will be meeting industry in that week of the week directly after we come back from Bonn. To have the first discussion with industry on the intended nationally determined contribution, and then we will line up a series of conversations with different stakeholder groupings and move into the provincial consultation. In terms of, I think, your deeper question about where are we in relation to where our emissions will be in 2020, The key moment is that period basically between 2020 and 2025 when we're expecting the emissions to bend the curve, because 2025 to 2035 is the plateauing period. So it's whether there will be sufficient built into the system through the carbon tax, through the carbon budgeting, through the various other instruments that Deborah outlined, through the various programs that are already in place, the renewable energy, the IPP programs, the various programs in place, to enable South Africa to actually bend the curve from going upwards. And at the moment, we are on an upward emissions growth trajectory, and whether we are actually at 2025 able to bend the curve. But our expectation is that it will not happen exactly at that period. And in all likelihood, we will overshoot that 583 megatons. The question would be then how South Africa is able to increase the levers at our disposal, the instruments at our disposal, increase the tax, increase the carbon budgeting, increase the various suite of instruments, and increase the efforts through our programmatic efforts to reduce emissions, to be able to catch up. Reducing emissions that are on their way up is not an easy exercise. That's the reality, and it requires the kind of coordination that you're talking about across sectoral departments, across industry, across the different stakeholder groups, to be able to make that significant shift. The reason that the carbon tax would not be sufficient is that we would not get the kind of emission reductions that would be necessary to bend the curve. And that is why we're looking at a suite of different instruments, a suite of instruments that enable industry to plan in a short, medium, and long term and make the kind of investments that they would need to make. A suite of instruments that would also enable us to capture the kind of efficiency that industry has already achieved so that there is credit due, there is credit given where there is credit due. but also a series of instruments that are mutually reinforcing, and instruments that enable South Africa to make that transition to a lower carbon economy. In terms of the question about, I think on the consolidated, the question about the legislation, we are in the process of putting together a discussion document that would conceptualize and frame the nature of the legal instruments that we would need in order to achieve have a coherent and consolidated legal basis for the mitigation system. So we would hope to be able to provide a discussion document towards the end of this year for your consideration that would give the outline of such a piece of legislation. Deborah will, I think, if necessary, add to the question of alignment of carbon budget, carbon tax, also the mitigation technology plan, and also I think where the discussions are with business in terms of the design of a mitigation system. I think what I do need to, and also the sensitivity analysis question, what I do need to respond to is this issue of air quality going against its own legislation. That is really absolutely an incorrect decision. It was department going against its own air quality legislation. The air quality legislation provides for a postponement of the time frame for compliance with emission standards. And the reason that we built that postponement into the legislation is exactly because of the challenge of a transition, a green transition, a transition to, and here we're talking about air pollutants, and I think we need to distinguish between greenhouse gases and air pollutants. The postponement legislation is directly applicable to air pollutants, which is sulfur dioxide, nitrogen, oxides of nitrogen, and particulate matter, whether it's the different sizes of particulate matter, and then ozone. The department went through an extremely rigorous exercise, which was presented to the committee previously, of ensuring that the postponements were not undermining the intentions of the legislation, that the postponements were put in place in the context of the kind of equality impact that were presented as part of the postponement application. And indeed, the priority areas are a challenging space, and I think what we also presented to the committee at that time is it's a challenging space because of a variety and diversity of sources of air pollution, including dust from unpaved roads, including burning of coal at breathing level for heating and for cooking, as well as for industry. If necessary, Chair, we can go further into the decisions that were made on those postponement applications. But I just want to clarify that this was a very, very robust and technical exercise that the department went through in making those postponement decisions. There was a further issue around the relationship between the air pollutants and the greenhouse gas issues, and I think it was synergies. Perhaps you can come back to me.
Deborah, do you want to pick up the other issues?
Okay.
Thanks. The question on where are we with industry, we're working very closely with them, as I've indicated earlier on, that there's a lot of data that we don't have. So we rely on them to provide the data on the carbon budget. It's not an easy process. You're basically telling people that you can continue with business as usual. So there's a bit of resistance at times, but I think we're getting there in terms of finding each other in this process. But it's just not easy. The question on productivity analysis, and we acknowledge that we need aggressive growth rates.
the intention here was to make sure that we are consistent and aligned with all other government policies. We have a tendency in government to use different assumptions. As a result, you can't compare documents with products that you come up with. So the reason why we went to the NDP assumptions is because of that reason. But as I indicated that we are about to update the MPA, so we will probably run a specific analysis on the current growth rates because we are nowhere near the growth rates that we've used for the MPA. The question on the numbers from the reference case, the without measures numbers there basically show that if we were to continue business as usual, no intervention at all, this is how far our emissions will grow. And with existing measures, it's basically the existing measures that are being implemented currently as we speak. In this case, it excludes things like carbon tax because we have not started implementing carbon tax. But existing measures that have been implemented, all the interventions that have been implemented by industry, including your IRP as well, that's the numbers there.
When you say lower intermittent, is that one
of the... I'm not responding. There is a check.
Okay. The numbers lower in Twitter, those are the lower numbers that you can get if we implement all the interventions. And there is just an example of some. There's a list of interventions that we can with it. That's the lower number for that range for that year. And then.
Yes, on the map.
Sorry, Chair, I just want to know lower than what? Lower than 1695 metric tons? Or, because it says 102 metric tons lower. So 102 lower than what? Is it lower than the first bullet point of 1695 metric tons? I'm just not sure.
That's the lowest that we can get in 2015 if we were to implement this intervention. If you go into the MPA, and I can pull out the numbers in terms of the higher ranges that you can get if you were to implement some of the interventions. Because remember, you may have 100 interventions that are being implemented. So you select a few that you can implement and look at the impact, and you select a few that you can implement and look at the impact. Okay, the other question on the alignment of carbon tax and carbon budget, as Susan indicated, we're working on different options. We have now proposed to them an option that will carry less risk in terms of combining the two instruments. We propose that we have an additional exemption for carbon budgets. That's still a matter under discussion between the two departments, so we don't have the final option in terms of how to align the two instruments at the moment. The question on the mitigation technology plan and the shift towards renewables, the intention of coming up with the mitigation technology plan was precisely that, to look at opportunities in terms of creating new industries, for instance, for renewables, and we'll make that document available as soon as we can.
So in your next presentation to the committee, is it possible that we can have all departments that have anything to do with climate change on our side? What we will do, we will be interacting with the relevant portfolio committees so that whatever document we craft on our IMDC, that document finds concrete acceptance with all of us and same interpretation as well. But also our action plans as government. That indeed there is alignment amongst all of us. And in that we have action plans that speak to what are the steps and plans we will undertake to avert any climate catastrophe in the country. Within our national climate response policy, of course, also within our green economy strategy, all these things are again within our MCF, within all these instruments, so that at least we find one another. Our difficulty is that if we are unable, if we rely on the instrument and we are unable to benefit action plans that arise from these instruments, come 2020, we might be where we are. Come 2025, We might be speaking wonderful politics of climate change, but not having any action plans to back such politics. So this is what we'll do on our side. We'll speak to the relevant portfolios so that when we meet, now we meet all of us together, and we also agree that this is already we have spoken to some of these committees, because all of us understand that these are crocketing matters. And we can't oversight and oversee them through silo portfolio committee work. It's just not working. So this is what we'll then say in as we part. But again, thank you very much. We have a sense of where we are. We know it will be very difficult. And again, that's why we need to work together for us to make that transition from upward movement to leveling up. So, it's that once we do that at this, we can then say probably we'll then go down. But once we're going up, the question is, will we be able to work together to effect a plateauing in terms of our scenario bending? Will we be able? And we can not be able to do that in us working as little parliamentary committees that each one is oversighting this little aspect. We need to oversight the entirety of the program. And all of us speak from the same page. And at the moment, I don't even know if we're speaking from the same page. But be that as it may, then thank you. And we hope that those that are you one of those that are going to bond. We wish you all the best. We know that you represent all of us. Because you see, the other reality is that Africa as a whole is also looking at the leadership of South Africa on these matters. And if we don't give the leadership, not through spinning, through actual deeds that are scientific, that we can demonstrate, we might even lose the leadership role that we play. So South Africa, and again, of course, we don't only want to lose the leadership role, we want to ensure that we don't lose it, but we also want to ensure that even those who will come after us can see how we dealt with this or abetted this catastrophe. We like, there must be evidence that we as Parliament of South Africa, we as the government of South Africa, these are the plans we have put in place to avert these catastrophes that might ensue or that will in fact ensue if we don't deal with this matter in a collective manner. But again, thank you very much. If you can just give us those pictures that are there, you know, you told us of a coordination or intergovernment committee on climate change and the various pictures. After you have given us that, we can then see what structuring can we come up with in Parliament to then do proper oversighting of this important matter. But again, thank you very much. If you can express the same to the acting DDG and the DDG, or the acting DG and the DG, who's now back, and wish them speedy recovery on our behalf. We want to see the DG back here before she goes wherever she's going to. Of course, also to the minister, we know that she's not around. You can also express our appreciation that you were able to come here to represent the department. These are very delicate matters, of course. You see, we have never, as the world community, been faced with this matter that needs all of us to work together. And that's why the COP21 is so important. And one issue, again, that you must all have is at the back of your mind, is whatever position we have as South Africa, how does that position come to Parliament? Because we can't come to Parliament through this COVID on environmental affairs. There must be a mechanism in which our position to COP21 will find concrete expression in the Parliament of the Republic. And we debate that position. We must bring it there, and but before that debate, there must be processing. There must be processing of such a position of our government. Probably some of the processing are the provincial meetings that we are speaking to, the interaction with stakeholders, including the various sectors of our economy, the NGOs, the CTOs, but ultimately, as Parliament, we can't go there without something that has been a subject of discussion within our Parliament. I think with colleagues, I'm going to close the meeting if we have nothing else to add.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think that the points that are being raised really assist us in the work that we are doing. So thank you.
Colleagues, that then adjourns this meeting until we see you again some other time. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Those of you who want to do something to eat in the family, you look in college, if you are going to